All right, everyone. It is Pete. It is Brian. We are Comic Books Transformed, and we are going to talk about 2018's Bumblebee. This is all in preparation for Transformers Rise of the Beasts, which is coming out in just a few weeks. Brian, do you like Transformers at all?
Yeah.
For those of you listening at home to the podcast, Brian is in Cybertron right now. Like, literally, he has, like, the population of the planet Cybertron behind him. Yes.
Yeah, to say that I'm hyped for this movie would be quite an understatement.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Are you hyped or are you worried about Rise of the Beasts?
I think I'm a little more hyped than worried.
Okay.
I think I have to preface everything that I'm a staunch defender of most of the Transformers movies, with the exception of last night. I just don't, I can't. I disliked the last night so much in the theater that I don't believe I saw Bumblebee in the theater.
Okay.
Which is, to me, is insane. I normally go to see every movie when it opens at the crazy giant IMAX in Lincoln Center. That's, you know, like the size of a house. Like, it's literally enormous. And I didn't go for that because I was so just down on the last night. Yeah. And I think Bumblebee definitely helped kind of reignite my faith a little bit. It's not perfect or anything like that, but it was a step in the right direction, honestly. And honestly contains one of the best scenes in any of live action Transformers movies.
Yes. Within
2 minutes. So.
Right, and that's one thing that I worry about with Bumblebee, or I guess I worried before I rewatched it, was would it have the same effect as the Batman, the most recent one, the Robert Pattinson Batman? Because I feel like that movie like shoots its movie load like right away with that amazing, amazing sequence, that montage of Gotham, and then, you know, the Batman shows up, we have the bat signal, all the criminals are afraid of Batman showing up, and then I feel like everything in the rest of the movie is not as good as that moment. And then Bumblebee has this amazing Cybertron sequence. And I was like, oh, this is going to be so good. And then am I not going to like the rest? But on second viewing, I'd have to say that even though that sequence is like a wet dream, because they've already said blow load and wet dream already, 2 minutes in. But I feel like it's just a good overall movie that is made in the same vein as like things that we saw as kids, live action movies like that.
Yeah, I agree. It does take place in the 80s, and it does have kind of like that like an 80s adventure movie kind of vibe to it.
Right. And I mean, Haley Steinfeld is fantastic. We can kind of go over each of the highlights of the movie in a second, but I really like when you made these notes today that you went over the behind the scenes stuff. That's, to me, that's really important to kind of go over who's actually making this movie. And I think that what makes this movie so different is because, you know, Michael Bay is not involved at all. And
well, he still is an executive producer, so he was involved in some capacity, as is Steven Spielberg, which, I mean, who knows how much he actually does on it, but, I mean, his name has been attached to all of them.
Yeah. It's kind of like, Michael Bay's not, like, completely removed from the project, but then he's not, like, directing it, which makes a big difference. So, Travis Knight, you listen to his credits in here. He did Kubo and the Two Strings. He was a producer on Paranorman, Missing Link. I think that had like Hugh Jackman in it, right?
I want to say it was Hugh Jackman. Yeah, I have not. I've seen some of Paranorman. I don't think I saw Missing Link. But I mean, the real important thing is that every one of those movies is stop motion.
Yeah.
Did I forget one? Was he on the Box Trolls too? I forgot the right Box Trolls down.
That would sound right. That the Paranorman and Missing Link absolutely look like they're the same kind of world or design as Box Trolls.
Yeah, I believe he's involved in that as well.
Well, so, I mean,
prior to Bumblebee, this is Kubo and the Two Strings is the only movie he's actually directed.
Okay. Well, regardless of him being a producer or a director, obviously he's involved with these stop motion films. And I think that, like, one thing that is a major highlight for Bumblebee 2018 is how expressive Bumblebee is, especially with his eyes. And that's a marked improvement from the Bumblebee of the Bay films. Like, Bumblebee is so much more emotive in this movie. And I think
he's a lot more human in this movie because he has a lot more time to grow because the focus is on, you know, him and Charlie for the most of the movie.
Right. And I think that probably having worked with, like, stop motion animation, like, where you're essentially getting a performance, getting emotions from like clay or from objects. Same exact thing with Bumblebee.
It's an excellent point. Yeah.
Thanks. I try to make those sometimes. Christina Hodson, you have her listed as making the Birds of Prey movie, which I liked. The Batgirl movie, which no one has seen. Yes. And then the Flash. My question is she the one that has written the most, like the version of the Flash that we're going to see?
I believe she was involved in the later production.
Okay.
It can't be post-production. It was like a post. She wrote a screenplay at some point. I think it was later on.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, we've discussed this before on our channel, you know, where comic books transformed, but I actually really enjoyed that Birds of Prey movie. You did too, right?
Yes, I liked the movie a lot too, yeah.
Yeah. I wish we could see that Batgirl, and then Fast X, I'm guessing that's kind of fun, but I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it. I have not seen any of those movies. I toyed with the idea of going to see it, because yeah. I was just bored with my son, and but he ultimately just wanted to go outside instead, so.
Oh, what? This kid wants to go play in nature? Come on. I just want to see a movie of Vin Diesel. Maybe. Yeah. But I was going to say, they just released a pitch meeting for Fast 10.
See, I tend to not watch the pitch meetings or, you know, anything really that I haven't seen. Like, it doesn't make as much sense to me.
Yeah.
If I hadn't seen the movie, so I can't laugh with it, you know?
Totally understand. If you ever want to watch, like, all the Fast movies and we could, like, bullshit about them on here, even though they have nothing to do with comic books, I would do that with you.
Sure, maybe. Yeah. I mean, from what I understand, especially the later ones, they're basically Transformers movies without robots.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, and it seems like they have superpowers, too, so we could go either way. But, I mean, you know, we have to settle for some shit. We're going to eventually watch more BS on this channel, too, so who knows,
yeah.
Man. Yeah, yeah.
You know what? Speaking of Morbius, you know, I was just before we were on here.
What?
I was watching the game, like the extended game trailer of the new Spider-Man game.
Oh yeah.
Oh boy, man, I always knew that like there was a good Kraven story around. You know, like I mean, there is good Kraven stories, but like, you know, he's should be a higher tier than most consider him, I think.
Yeah, well, I thought that Jason Momoa was going to be Kraven in a movie, but it's the guy that played Quicksilver, right?
Yeah, Aaron Taylor Johnson, yeah. So Kick-Ass and Quicksilver. I just think it's so funny that he was this tiny little nerd, kind of scrawny little nerd in Kick-Ass. And, you know, he clearly bulked up for Quicksilver, too. And probably even more so for this.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't watched the, like, I know there's one with, like, Kraven. Like right away we see him, he looks real imposing. And I've seen footage where like Spider-Man kind of like comes over a barn and he's got like the symbiote on him and it's kind of reaching out like Dr. Octopus's tentacles. I haven't watched that full clip though.
Yeah, I was maybe a minute from finishing it, but and the lizard too. Lizard looks awesome. Nice. I'm real excited for this game. And you get to switch back and forth between Peter and Miles too, which is extra awesome.
Oh, that's cool. And then is it like Venom voiced by Tony Todd?
I believe so, yeah.
Oh, that's hot. Yeah. Dude, we have just like talked about like 15 fucking things that aren't Bumblebee.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go back. So, in your notes, you were talking about how the reception, it did poorly financially. Like, basically, at the box office, it had a $21 million opening weekend. It made $127 million domestic and then $340 internationally. But the budget was $467 million.
No. That was the total take was $437. The budget was $135.
Oh, what a fucking idiot. I'm reading this. Yeah, duh. The movie's going to cost $467 million, even though
yeah. I mean, that's a little excessive, I think. But
yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say that it's interesting. I really do think that The Last Knight really lost a lot of goodwill. I think there was already kind of a downturn domestically with Transformers. The highest grossing film domestically was Revenge of the Fallen. And then it went down as it each time afterwards that domestically and increased internationally, with the exception of Last Knight, which had less, and then this would have even less than that.
Yeah, it's so funny because like I remember Revenge of the Fallen being like this big financial hit, but like everyone admitted that it was a shitty movie, you know?
Yeah, it's a pretty shitty movie. You know, it's a victim of the writer's strike. How much of a difference that could have made? Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, it might have been a turn either way. You never know.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that this writer's strike doesn't fuck up Transformers 1,
which just got pushed back, if you didn't hear. It was supposed to be July something, and now it's like September. That's another important part about Bumblebee. Each of the Transformers movies previously released in June. Prime time summer blockbuster Deadpool time when everyone goes to the movies. This was released the week of Christmas. 2019, which is, I know the, Spider-Man has had success and that's that slot. We know that from both Into the Spider-Verse and No Way Home.
Yeah.
But, I don't think it's traditionally as strong of a time frame for movies to premiere.
Yeah, for blockbusters. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I mean, they did kind of switch things up. Like, I know that, like, Star Wars would always come out in May. And then with the new sequel trilogy, it started to come out around Christmas time, too.
That's true, too, yeah.
Yeah, but it's funny. I remember seeing this in the theater, and the movie itself is such a summer movie, right? Like, it's at the theme park for a lot of it, and they're driving around. I mean, it's California.
It's but, Southern California, I mean.
yeah. It could be like that in December, I guess, too. But you mentioned a little bit further down in the notes the music. And when I think about the beginning of this movie and when I think about the theme park, I think about the music. We're, of course, going to talk about the Cybertron part. But, like, we need to build up a little bit after we just blew our load, We have to, we'll get to that Cybertron part in a second. But you said, is this, like, a result of Guardians of the Galaxy? Because that's this very, like, in-your-face 80s soundtrack for this movie. And to me, I feel like there is a distinction between when you apply a soundtrack appropriately and, like, when it's just like, oh, here's this. Remember this? Remember this? And I feel like, unfortunately, Bumblebee is more like the in-your-face remember this.
Yeah, it's an in-your-face remember this because they have to get, drive home the fact that it's an 80s movie.
Yeah.
Because, you see giant, robots that turn into cars and jets and helicopters and shit. And, it kind of, and they're trying to say, like, yes, this is different than the last movies. We're in a different time, so we have to remind you by playing old music to, to keep keep it all together.
Yeah. And like, I feel like in all the things where they just overdose on movies, I guess two is set up the, the setting, right? Like you're saying, I feel like they just like really shove it in your face in the beginning and then it gets like, they sort of like peter it out more towards the end. And in this one, I felt like it was one after the other. It has a couple of songs I really like, but I feel like some of them are just like so obvious. Like, okay, yeah, it's the 80s. We get it. Of course, as Stan Bush's You've Got the Touch.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I appreciated that it all sounded like music that the character would listen to.
Yes.
A lot of the Smiths, they reference the Smiths in the movie. So, on one hand, like, I agree with you that it's more in your face, but it's not, like, totally. I think it does help color Charlie a little bit.
Yeah. I think you're right, and there is a sort of like emotional beat where they use music at the very end because like Bumblebee goes to go fight the Decepticons and he wants Charlie to stay out of the way, and that's where he has the ability to like use music to kind of communicate, and he plays a Smith song of like "I don't want you to get hurt" is one of the lyrics, and I didn't pick up on that the first two times I saw it in the theater. I was like, oh, that's cool that like he's using like the specific band that she really likes to get the point across to her.
And especially previously when he heard the song and he ejected the tape immediately.
Shoots the tape out. Yeah, I love that from the trailers. And that brings up a thing that I wanted to talk about too. It's not in the notes, but like just going back to that sort of fact that the director made these stop motion movies and he was making animated movies, there is a layer to this movie that it's like it's more creative looking than if just some generic hired gun director would make. Like there's a couple of shots in this movie where you're like, oh, okay, it's interesting that they shot it this way. Because otherwise it could be just very standard. A lot of it is generic, but like there's like shots where like, for instance, when he shoots the tape out at her, you see it from like the tape's perspective, like flying out at her face. And that's cool. There's a shot where she like takes a part out of Bumblebee and she's like looking inside of him and like you're looking from Bumblebee's like inside out at her. I like little touches like that which just make this movie like a little bit more than just like a generic adventure movie.
Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah. So let's talk about what you put for the plot, okay? So the Decepticons are hunting the Autobots. There's no crazy MacGuffin, thank Jesus. This is in every fucking Transformers movie. So is it a positive or negative to me? It's an absolute positive. I love that there's no fucking, like, in ancient Earth past, this happened. Like, fuck that.
Yeah, I again agree. The smaller scale helped this movie a lot. And this is one of the things that has me worried. One of the reasons why I would be worried about the newer movie. The newer movie definitely seems to have that end of the world MacGuffin-y vibe.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's a strike, but it's a potential strike against it.
Yeah.
I think this movie, the new movie, is going to be more like the Bay movies than we think. But I think it's going to learn a little bit from this movie. And I certainly hope it does. But this is clearly one point that it's not.
Yeah. I mean, in every single live-action Transformers movie, it seems that it's crucial that you have one young human character, and then you have like an Autobot counterpart for them. Bumblebee has been that character pretty much every single time, but now we're gonna have Mirage for Rise of the Beasts. And yes. I think that, like you've already said a couple of times, the relationship between Charlie and Bumblebee is really great. It's like genuine, and he's not just like the comic relief. Like, there's a genuine care. Like what's weird about the Shia LaBeouf Bumblebee relationship is that sometimes he kind of seems like Bumblebee's like his pet, and he seems like he cares about Bumblebee, but he kind of does treat him like an object. Like, women, like so much in the Bay films, so many things are treated just like objects, including the Transformers themselves. Whereas in this movie, Bumblebee is like a creature that Charlie cares for and wants to take care of.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, hopefully. Maybe there'll be sort of like a friendship between, Mirage and whatever the fucking human counterpart's name is.
Noah.
Noah, okay, thank you. And, you know, looking at the couple in this movie with Charlie and the boy that, like, tries to get with her, it was almost like if you made this movie, like, a little later in time, it could have been, like, their kid, you know?
Well, yes and no. You mean Sam could have been their kid? Noah could have been their kid.
Right, the kid in Rise of the Beasts.
Interesting, yeah, that would be interesting. But I think that, the human characters from this movie are not going to be present whatsoever.
So Charlie, we obviously love Hayley Steinfeld. I know you're a fan. You love her as Hawkeye, Kate Bishop. I love her too. I think she's great in every movie I've ever seen her in. Let's talk about the other people that are in this movie, though. Since I mentioned her little kind of boyfriend guy, what do you think about him in this movie?
Memo.
Yeah.
I forget the actor's name, but I always remember that he's in, you know, the Tom Holland Spider-Man movies. He's always one of the guys in the little newsroom at the high school.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
honestly, his role was a little unnecessary. And I don't want to say unnecessary because there needs to be, you know, some other person that's involved here, but like, he didn't do very much. I don't think.
No,
I don't think he had much to work with. I don't think he did very much. So, like, really, Charlie is 100% the heart of the movie, other than Bumblebee. And I would say that I honestly didn't care too much for any of the other human characters.
Yeah,
unfortunately,
not even John Cena.
I remember being very hard on John Cena when I first saw this movie. That was obviously pre-Peacemaker.
Yeah.
Now I love John Cena because I could see the kind of, you know, comedic range he has, but I don't think he had much to work with here.
He has the best line in the entire movie where he's like, they're called Decepticons, you know, like it's in their name. Like that's one of the best jokes in the whole franchise of the live action.
Yes, and 100% is, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I know what you're saying. He is very one-dimensional. He actually does have a really good, I mean, it's not really a good line, but his comedic timing is really good when he's meeting with Charlie's mom and like her stepdad figure, and the guy's like, oh, I once stole some Malamars when I was a teenager. He's like, we know. Do you remember that?
Yes, and they do a quick cut after that. That was a good joke.
Yeah. I love that too. It's funny. There's a couple of funny beats, but so the kid's name is Memo.
Memo, yeah.
Memo. So with Memo, I agree with what you said. Like, he didn't, the actor didn't have a lot to work with. He kind of feels like a little bit like he could be forgettable, or like, oh yeah, he's in this movie too. He doesn't really play a prominent role until the third act of the movie, where he's there to kind of help Charlie and just be that other human that's going to support her. But I think he does a good job. There's this weird scene where, like, Charlie gets him to take his shirt off. And I was thinking of, like, plot-wise, why is that necessary?
Yeah, I didn't get that either. It's like he's, you know, she has a two shirts on. He's got one shirt on, and then that, but she's not interested in him that way. I mean, she clearly makes that very clear throughout the movie. She's not interested in that. So it was really weird to put them to put that in there.
Yeah, yeah. And also, just like showing how not interested she is, like the last beat before the title card comes up, because there's a thing after the title card too, but like the way the movie ends with the title card, it's like he kind of awkwardly goes to touch her hand, and then she goes, maybe not yet. And like they look at each other awkwardly, and it's just so fucking awkward of a moment.
Very awkward, yeah.
And it just goes, Bumblebee! You know, it's like, thank God they show Bumblebee and Optimus after that, because it's just such an awkward way to end the movie. You know?
I mean, especially if they show that. I mean, obviously you needed to see, you saw Bumblebee reuniting with Optimus.
Yeah.
Trailer. And you needed to see Charlie going back to her family too. But yes, that was a little awkward. But I mean, at the same time, I'm kind of glad they didn't get together sort of thing.
Right.
I mean, it's such a cliche thing, and I'm always kind of happy to see it because you don't see it that often.
Right. So let's address what you said right here, which is the reboot or not reboot. So you want to just kind of basically sum up what you wrote in the notes over here?
I mean, to me, this is a soft reboot. Soft reboot meaning they're just kind of restarting it. They're going to make a new trilogy out of it. It sort of can connect. It sort of couldn't if you wanted it to go either way.
Yeah.
There are things that contradict it, but there are things that say it goes with it too. There are a lot of people that just get real mad on the internet when you try to say it's a soft reboot.
Yeah.
I don't know why. They think you're like clinging to the Bay movies and you can't let go. I'm like, no, it's just factual things there. It's just, you have to acknowledge it. You can't ignore it. Yes, it could be a hard reboot, but I mean, the producers of Rise of the Beast are basically saying that, you know, there is a path here that connects to the other movies. Like they mentioned Optimus's character arc and how he's not quite the person, the character yet that he was in the 2007 movie. So they clearly are trying to connect it in some way. But to me, this is an X-Men first class in a situation where, yes, it sort of works, but there are so many contradictions that it's like funny, you know?
Yes. I mean, in your notes, you mentioned how Megatron is not in the movie, but originally I think Megatron, they did have it that he was going to be in that Cybertron sequence.
I'm not sure. I've never heard that before. But
oh, really?
Yeah, but like he's very clearly absent there. You get all the other major cons there. You got Soundwave, Starscream, Shockwave, but no Megatron. So in the 07 movie, Megatron's been crashed there on Earth for a long time.
Yeah.
And just the fact that, you know, Sector 7 is the human organization that's involved in the movie, which is the same organization in the Bay movies, and that, you know, they're based in the Hoover Dam where Megatron's body is frozen.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we see a young Agent Simmons in this movie. He has like one line and he's in like one or two scenes, but I mean, clearly they made it in a way where it could connect to those movies.
Okay. So that's where I'm a little confused though, because if Sector 7 exists and they've already found Megatron's body, and I think they would have found the cube by this point too, the AllSpark, right?
So
they seem pretty shocked when these Decepticons show up. Not necessarily shocked, but it's not like, oh, they're here. Like there's no line where someone says they're just like the other one that we have.
Yeah, you know? The only thing I can think of there is that it's possible. You know, I'd have to go look up and see when they found him. I don't think that's ever addressed in the movies at what point they found him. Maybe it is after that. Maybe they just, you know, took information they had. Clearly what they were building was a tracker to track Cybertronian energy signatures.
Yeah.
So maybe they just used that after they left, and then they found Megatron in the Arctic after that.
Okay.
Like, he's in the dam, and he's covered in ice, but it's like, if he was there for 30, 40 years, wouldn't the ice have melted by now or something? Or, you know, like, wouldn't they have done something if he wasn't, if he was there for that long?
Okay. That is a really interesting point. I think that in the first Bay movie, they say that they, like, built the dam because of Megatron.
Oh, yeah, right? Maybe.
But yep. And in the movie, they do kind of show, like, tubes that are keeping Megatron frozen, too.
Again, that's a great point. It's like, you know, that's a way that it's not. But, like, why still include Sector 7? Why still include Agent Simmons?
Right. Dude, I mean, I totally agree with you on that. And actually, it brings up another point that I thought of, too, which is, what the fuck are the Decepticons? It's Dropkick and what's the other one?
Shatter and Dropkick. Who are not named. They're not named in the movie.
Okay. All right. So Shatter and Dropkick, they essentially have, like, created internet on Earth in the 1980s. And it's like, wouldn't they find Megatron if they're, like, connected to everything too, like, electronically?
I mean, I get that they found Bumblebee because of this crazy power surge he had when he stuck his finger in the socket.
Right.
So I imagine that, you know, Megatron is deactivated currently. You know, he's on ice. He's probably not putting off that strong of a signal. And their goal was to find Bumblebee.
Okay. All right. Yeah. That's kind of
time that you could argue, like, you know, maybe they would have found that and they would have commented on something during it. Because obviously Megatron's their leader, you know. But there's right. no mention of Megatron anywhere.
Right. Yeah, and all this stuff is like hand-wavy stuff of like, oh, well, this explains why this. But like, I remember that in the first Bay movie, they find Megatron. Like, Frenzy goes onto like Air Force One and is able to find Megatron by like hacking into Air Force One. So it's like they're kind of hacking already with the Sector 7 people, but whatever, it doesn't matter.
I think you can argue that, you know, the Decepticon, you know, Shatter and Dropkick did not get their message out, so no one knows what happened to them or why. So yeah. I think it's fair that, you know, none of the other Decepticons would know where he was after that, even if they did find him or something. So
yeah. Well, let's talk about the Decepticons for a couple minutes. So before we get to the opening, too, I know it's in your notes, but these two specific Decepticons, Dropkick and Shatter. Shatter's Angela Bassett, which I was trying to think of, like, movies that I've actually seen Angela Bassett in, and I hate to say this, but I think it's only been the two Black Panther movies.
More recently, it's the Black Panther movies, but, like, oh, God, what was the thing? She's been so many things in the 90s.
Well,
she's been a long time, man.
But did she play Tina Turner in What's Love Got to Do with It?
Oh, my God. I think she did. Yeah.
Right. You know, RIP Tina Turner, right, who just passed away yesterday. But I know she's a talented actress, and she was, you know, really amazing in the most recent Black Panther. But she's great in this, even though she's just sort of providing a voice. I think they did that thing where, like, they kind of made the Decepticon's face kind of look like hers, or kind of like move like hers would.
Yeah, there's always some kind of visual cue taken. Maybe it's just our own brains just trying to, like, hear the voice and knowing that it, and you're just kind of thinking that
maybe
it's kind of an illusion. Yeah. But they definitely, it's not super obvious. Not like what was that the underwater movie with Will Smith as a fish, like
oh, Will Shark Tale.
Was it Shark Tale? Like, you know, like, the fish clearly look like Will Smith. whatever clearly look like Angelina Jolie. Like, you know, it's not like that obvious. But
yeah,
I do think you're right. Like, I do feel like that. Although I can't see the reason why I think it's our brains tricking us is that I barely know Justin Theroux. I do not know him from many things.
Okay. So Justin Theroux, because I was going to ask you about this too. He's the guy that was married to Jennifer Aniston. I think he might still be married to her, right? And he's like in The Leftovers. It's that guy, right?
I didn't see The Leftovers. The only thing I have actually seen him in other than Bumblebee was a Netflix show called, was it Maniac? With Jonah Hill and Emma Stone. He plays this, like, weird-ass doctor, and I loved him in it.
Oh, yeah. I just looked him up. He is the guy that was married to Jennifer Aniston.
Yes, he is married to Jennifer Aniston, or was, yes. And also, I'll switch my thought. It's gone.
Never mind. I mean, it's funny that they have to pick somebody even of his caliber. I mean, I wouldn't say he's, like, this super well-known star, but, you know, obviously he has a, you know, name out there. And I feel like Dropkick barely says anything in this whole movie.
He says a little bit, but he's more of a henchman type to Angela Bassett's kind of like leader character.
Right.
He's like, you don't get the it's not like Megatron Starscream. It's like, you know, she's like a lieutenant and he's like, you know, a private or something. I don't know.
Yeah. And they're pretty vicious. You know, Dropkick has this like power, this gun to just essentially like pop people. That's pretty horrifying, I think.
Yeah, it totally was. Yeah.
It's like something out of like Mars Attacks or, you know, just something where like humans just get destroyed horribly, but it's the aliens are just like, who cares?
Yeah, it is very cartoonish and comical in a way because it's like a bubble popping, you know?
Right.
It almost looks like it's a microwave, you know?
Yeah. And it makes sense because, you know, we are made up of so much water, right? Yeah. But I like that they'd be considered triple changers because they can turn into two different things.
Okay. That's something that we don't really see in any of the previous movies. And that was one of like the cooler gimmicks to me, from the toy line when I was a kid. Like, you know, obviously the best thing was combiners. Like, no, there's no argument there for me.
Yeah.
City bots were awesome because they're just the size of them. Yeah. And triple changers. I mean, half the time they looked, you know, they're a little suspect because, you know, some mode has to suffer. But the idea they could be three things instead of just two is awesome.
Oh, well, here's this. I don't want to, like, risk my Transformers card, but Blitzwing is a triple changer too, right?
That's correct. Well, the original Blitzwing was, not the Blitzwing in this movie.
Okay, right. Because, like, the original Blitzwing is a tank, a jet, and then he's a bot too.
Yeah, yes.
Okay, so then, and I love Blitzwing from the 86 movie. He's in such an awesome part. But in this, he looks like Starscream when you see the trailer and stuff.
Yeah, no, when you see the trailer, you absolutely think that's a Starscream redesign. You know, yeah. I mean, on one hand, I'm glad it's not because he dies immediately.
Yeah.
Like, man, like that's the thing that sold me in the trailer was that transformation. He's in the jet, and you see him charging forward, turning into a robot. That completely sold me on the movie.
Yeah. Well, I love that. I actually love that sequence where he's fighting Bumblebee. He's so mean to them. And that kind of goes along with this thing that I sort of forgot about, but watching it a third time, I was like, oh, yeah, I remember that it's very much like the Decepticons have conquered the Autobots, and they refer to the Autobots as like the Autobot Rebels. It's like the Decepticons. It's not like this idea of that they're two equal factions and that like Cybertron is destroyed. It's like the Decepticons have taken over and Cybertron is destroyed. And like they try to play it off with the humans like, oh, the Autobots are the dangerous ones. But they are very deadly. And when you get introduced to Dropkick and to Shatter, they just fucking kill Cliffjumper.
Poor Cliffjumper, who's turned into a long string of just cameos and deaths. You know, started with Transformers Prime, happened here.
Yeah.
He died at the very end of the IDW comic. His legacy now is to die, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, that was real brutal when I saw that. I was like, okay. And that was smart, too, because Cliffjumper, he's the same. He's Bumblebee, just different colors.
Yeah, essentially. Well, the old one's a little different, but he's essentially the same size, looks very similar.
All right, so then we've gone through a couple of your notes right here, but, you know, I think we should – why don't we just talk about the opening sequence, and then we can talk about the end of this movie.
It's the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. Honestly, when I first saw the scene, like, my jaw was just on the floor. Everything here, I mean, Cybertron and everything looks so different from the Bay movies. This is what I wanted to see originally when they said Transformers movie. Like, I wanted to see them sort of look like their cartoon counterparts.
Yes. And
that's what it is. Like, they look alien, they look different, you know, but they look sort of, I mean, as realistic as you can possibly say, you know. I think it works. Like, you don't need to have it be a gazillion gears and some barely splattered on colors to, you know, like the Bay movies and those designs. I think everything worked here amazingly.
Yeah. Well, you know, so many people have talked about the Transformers movies. They've talked about this movie. And one major distinction, and I know a lot of people have said this, but it's like the Decepticons in the Bay movies are like these just metal monsters that look like crabs, right? Whereas in this, they're like clearly the toy they're inspired by the toys, and they have distinct colors, you know.
Well, yeah, yeah, 100%. No Decepticon has color in, or very few have color. The Constructicons do, maybe some of the guys in Age of Extinction, but for the most part, they're just black and silver, and that's it.
Yeah, or like gray, right? Like Starscream's gray, Megatron's gray, Soundwave is gray, right? But that's the great part about this opening sequence, and it just cuts right to it. Cuts to Cybertron, like the first thing, like the first shot of the movie is just Cybertron from above. You see a whole bunch of Autobots. I mean, basically, you want to just name off all the Autobots we see.
Yeah, obviously, you see Optimus, you see Bumblebee, you do see Cliffjumper very briefly there. Mm-hmm. You have Ironhide and Ratchet, you have Brawn, and you have Wheeljack and RC.
That's right, they do show Wheeljack. That's right. Okay.
Yeah, and Wheeljack does have his classic look, unlike, you know, he looks in the new movie coming out.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. And then, so, what's his, Hound, right? Doesn't he get shot right in the very beginning?
No, that's Brawn.
I'm sorry. That's what I meant. Yeah, one name.
Yeah.
Yeah, he gets shot. And it's kind of reminiscent of the 1986 cartoon, too. Because he gets shot in the shoulder.
The shoulder, yeah. I mean, he does make it out. He is still there when they all escape, but you don't see him again.
Yeah. So in that, there's a shit ton of Seekers, and they just like are just mopping the floor with the Seekers in there. And the Seekers are like different colors. You do see Starscream a couple of times, and there's just this great fucking part where like they're fighting back against the Seekers, and Optimus is there, and they've kind of like regrouped, and then the bad guys just kind of all come together. I just love that so much.
Yeah.
You know, because like I think Bumblebee's like Optimus, and then like you see like Soundwave shows up, and then like Starscream shows up, and then Shockwave, and it's like, oh man, this like, is
oh
it.
Shit, they're fucked.
Right. And see, like, that's what a Transformers movie should do. It should convey this sense of like, oh no, these guys, you don't want to mess with these guys, you know?
Yeah, one of my favorite dynamics between Autobots and Decepticons, and I think it was probably best done in especially the earlier season of Transformers Animated, where the Decepticons are just giant fucking things, and they're just so powerful
that it
takes multiple Autobots to take them down or whatever. Yeah. I love that kind of dynamic, and you kind of get a little bit of that feeling here. Although they're kind of just mowing them down, especially Prime is just mowing people down.
Yeah.
But that's expected. That's what Prime does.
Right. So that sequence is fantastic, and there's even sort of little callbacks to the 1986 movie. I mean, RC's in it, and when Prime kind of shows up, it's a little bit like when he shows up on Earth, a little bit. He does this big kind of like leap and shoots with his gun. But what's weird, what always takes me out of that sequence is he says, where's B-127? And it's like, wait, why does he have like a number designation? And I understand from a logistic sense, it's like, why would he be called Bumblebees on another planet, right? But it's just, I'm not used to Transformers having numbers for names.
Yeah, they have to give him, they have to add the scene where Charlie kind of names him, later on. But it is definitely a little weird because he's B-127, but clearly Cliffjumper is Cliffjumper, and Prime is Prime. You know, I don't think they name anybody else.
Yeah.
But it was a little weird. I get why they did it, but it definitely is weird.
So I have a question for you, because you know this stuff way better than I do. Before the first Bay movie, was Bumblebee just not really? I mean, I understand that Bumblebee is super popular now. It's always like with Transformers, it's like people think Prime, Megatron, Bumblebee, and then that's
I would argue some people say Bumblebee before Prime even.
Yeah, right. And so I understand, like, what I'm just trying to get at is Bumblebee, I don't think of, was like one of the main guys to begin with.
100% was. In the first, in the opening three-parter, when we basically our three-parter, the kind of human friend character is actually Hound.
Right,
They decided to change it for some reason, and they made it Bumblebee. And Bumblebee is in more episodes than probably anybody other than Prime in the first two seasons. And also just the fact that he's one of the few that survive and still has lines in season three, speak volumes to me.
Oh man, I always think about that one like YouTube clip. It might even like predated YouTube, where Optimus Prime comes back to life. Do you remember that clip?
Dr. Smoove?
Yeah, I love that. He's like, you'll be cold. Yeah, yeah.
You're Her name is Shitpiece.
Dude, I'm gonna watch that after we stop recording. I love that shit. Okay, so we're talking about the Cybertron sequence. They all leave. There's a great sequence where the Seekers. I'm sorry. Bleh, that's gonna sound horrible audio wise. Where the Seekers like fly up and then shoot the tower, and then the oh, I love that sequence so much.
Yeah, great. Great little action sequence there. The Autobots are escaping. Prime's kind of acting as a diversion, and you're like, oh shit, like what's going on here?
Yeah, yeah.
And then later on in the movie, while Charlie and Bumblebee are kind of like training in the woods or just exploring whatever, Bumblebee kind of like gets hurt or falls down or something, and she like tries to put a piece back on, and then it triggers this projection of what happened afterwards from his point of view, I guess.
Very reminiscent of like Luke messing around with R2-D2, and then you see the message from Princess Leia. It's a great sequence, and then it's used again later in the movie where I think like Dropkick steps on Bumblebee and he activates the hologram too. So yeah, it's cool. Like plot wise, it moves the story forward. So I'm just trying to think. I mean, you have your notes right here. You asked the question of who is the most likable main human protagonist, Sam, Kate, or Charlie? I mean, clearly it's Charlie.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, it was an easy question there, no brainer sort of, but I had to throw it in there. I'm trying to think of something to say about the humans, because I mean, I am generally speaking, I want a movie of just robots, you know?
Right. And I guess we'll maybe get that with year one. That kind of leads up to this question that you have here at the very end, which is what could have made this movie better? That's a great fucking question. I feel like we should ask that for a lot of the movies that we review.
Yeah, wait, hold on a second.
Yeah, buddy, take your time, man. It's all good.
What do you mean, buddy? All right, I can't right now, bud, okay? He knocked the ball on the street.
Kids,
at least
man.
He's not going to run out and get it himself. We live in a busy street, so.
Come on. Doesn't he know we have to talk about movies that are based on toys? Come on.
Yes. I mean, he's back in the Transformers again. The trailers kind of got him into it again, so.
Good.
He just bought a Transformer himself with his own money again.
Nice. So what makes this movie better than The Last Knight? Where does this movie rank for you out of all the other live actions?
Yeah, so I guess, and what could they have done to make the movie better? So to me, one of the weak points of the movie is a lot of the human stuff feels just out of place or unnecessary. I definitely like the bonding of Bumblebee and Charlie, but I don't know. Sometimes I think there's too much. Obviously, it's way easier to film human actors than, you know, CG a bunch of transforming robots. I get that.
Yeah.
But I think maybe if they would have lightened up a little bit on that. One of the things that always takes me out of it is that the end sequence, although it looks awesome, the final battle with Bumblebee and versus Dropkick and Chatter is awesome. Yeah. The deaths those two characters have are fantastic.
Yeah.
But it's like Bumblebee gets captured. He gets the shit kicked out of him. He gets captured to also by Sector 7 again, which is the same thing that happens in the first 07 movie. So there's a couple of retreads there.
Yeah.
He gets captured. He gets the shit knocked out of him. And then, you know, he basically dies and comes back. And then he's able to take on two Decepticons by himself.
Right.
I find that to be a little far-fetched, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, I think that would have worked better if there was a couple Autobots here. Or maybe someone else. He met up with somebody else somewhere.
Yeah.
Later on or something. I always think about Short Circuit when I watch this movie. You know, at the end, Johnny Five is kind of like, he's got to go save whatever. I don't exactly remember, but he's like, he's running out of power, basically. And he's trying to accomplish his mission. I think that would have added a bit of danger, I guess.
Sure.
That would have appreciated it, and I think would have helped balance out if they would have added some other characters.
Yeah, I agree. It's funny because for me, what messes it up is like the kind of like cliche things, like, you know, Charlie, her dad died, right? So she wakes up in the morning, she puts on her headphones, and that's kind of like almost like Star-Lord too, where it's like you got to have music playing, and that's the 80s music once again. And then like she walks out of the room and she's like, good morning, dad. And it's like so clear that she is upset about her dad. Like everything about her dad is cliche. But like one thing I've mentioned on our show before is that cliches, you know, the reason why they exist is because they do kind of work. And I think that even though it's like, oh, okay, she's doing this, she's upset about her dad. Oh, she can't dive because she's thinking about her dad. Like, it kind of bothers me, but I still kind of tolerate it because I like the actress so much, Hailee Steinfeld.
Yeah, no, I actually like this plot line. The more I think I initially criticized it a little bit too, because it seems from the point of, like, you know, what did she need to do that for at the end? Like she eventually gets over the fear and dives in the end after Bumblebee's underwater, but yeah, she doesn't do anything like there. But yeah, I get it. It's and I actually appreciated that the character's in a different point in her life than, say, Sam was or Kate.
Yeah.
She's has a feeling of loss and she can't kind of get over it.
Yeah.
Bumblebee is helping her get over it, really, and accepting how to move forward. And once I kind of realized that, I'm like, yeah, total cliche, but I actually do like that aspect a lot.
Mm.
And even though the scene where she's going to go dive or whatever feels so out of place, you know, they're just driving and there's a bunch of kids on a cliff hanging out. That's like so weird.
Right. Okay. So I'm actually
get the point they're trying to drive across with it.
Right. I'm actually really glad that you brought up that specific scene, because it's one of those scenes that feels so unnatural. It's like they have to hit the story beat, and so it makes everything feel fake. Because like there's all these kids that are just gathered around this cliffside, and then the girl comes out, you know, Charlie comes out, and this one like hot guy is like, "Oh, we have an Olympic diver," you know. He's like no fucking teenager talks like that. Gather around, everyone. There's a legend, or whatever the fuck he says, and it's just it feels so unnatural. The only thing that kind of redeems that is when they go to get revenge on the girl that is mean to her, and then like Bumblebee just fucks up her car. I love that.
Yeah. Also, I always thought that woman, the actress that played Tina, you know, the bully girl.
Yeah.
She did not look like a high schooler.
No. And she's fucking miserable. Like, you know, she makes that joke of like, you should have your dad get a new car. And it's like, that's yet again another thing that feels unnatural, because I don't think that like someone would just say that.
Yeah.
It's mean-spirited, but I feel like it wouldn't come out that way. Like, oh, you should get a new car. Have your dad get a car. And it's just, it just kind of is like, oh, she's a bully. And then she's also reminding us that the dad died, you know, and it just doesn't feel right. So that's the kind of stuff that kind of bothers me on second viewing. But otherwise, I like the movie in general. I feel like if you start to take things out of this movie, it changes the DNA of it, and it wouldn't be – like, I just wouldn't like it as much. I don't know what would make this movie better. Maybe just, like, a little bit tightening up of scenes like that. But otherwise, I think what it's trying to do, it does very well.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, as far as my rankings, I would put this under the first Bay movie, but only because the first Bay movie is a much more like Transformers feeling adventure where there's multiple Autobots, there's multiple Decepticons. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I agree there. There's a feeling of like that feeling of wonder sort of the first time you see it.
Yeah,
with the Bay movie, so there is something special about that one.
Yeah,
although my favorite, I have this also below the first one.
Yeah,
although I mean, the more I think about it, it's they're very close. It's very close. Like I could flip that if I wanted to. My favorite still is Dark of the Moon.
Yeah,
the third one, because there's so many comic book storylines they're drawing from there, and not comic book. Cartoon storylines, the drawing from there.
Yeah, that, Space Bridge.
It really, I really takes me back, and I like that one a lot.
Yes, yeah. Dark of the Moon is great. I mean, because you have Leonard Nimoy, and that's, you know, reminding you of Galvatron, and just Leonard Nimoy in general is awesome. And then, you know, there's Sentinel Prime, obviously. Also with Dark of the Moon, there's that sequence where Sentinel Prime like tricks them and he kills Ironhide, and that very much feels like the movie.
Oh man, I was so shocked at that point too.
Yeah,
I did not see that coming.
right. Neither did Ironhide, you know, and like the way he dies is very brutal. Yeah. And you know, and it definitely feels kind of like the end of a trilogy, that one too. And like, but there's things I don't like about that. And Optimus just rips fucking Megatron's head off, and like his spine comes out, and blood goes everywhere. It's like
this. I mean, movie Optimus is definitely a bit more violent, I would say. I mean, in a way, it almost justifies the kind of Nemesis Prime vibe he gives off in the fifth movie, because he is a lot more brutal than any other version of Optimus before.
Yeah,
I hope that although these movies are supposed to connect to the 07 movies, I do hope they have that kinder what was the line that Peter Cullen says when he describes his audition? Yeah, there's this video where Peter Cullen is describing when he went to audition for it. He just like talked to his brother who was in the military, or Marines or something. And he said, he's like, don't play it like a Hollywood action type. Play it as strong, but strong enough to be kind. And I think that like perfectly sums up how he sounds in the cartoon. And I think that's the kind of character that, you know, that's the version of Optimus that I want to see the most.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that we both enjoy this movie a lot. We rank it pretty high among the Bay movies. We're sort of hoping that the Rise of the Beasts has some of this movie in its DNA. Is there anything else you wanted to add about Bumblebee?
No, I guess that's it.
Okay, cool. And then if you guys watch this whole video, please definitely subscribe to our channel. You know, me and Brian talk about stuff. We just covered Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse like 2 weeks ago. And then last week we covered...
That was last week.
I'm sorry. The school year just ended for me, so I'm a little frazzled. But yeah, we did that. And then we, before that, we covered... the fuck did we cover then?
I don't remember.
Well, no, because it's like... Oh, okay. I know what it is. It's Spider-Verse and then this. And then we're going to cover Flash next week because... We're gonna
cover the DC animated movie Flashpoint Paradox.
Correct. Right, and that's because like in the movies we're gonna get Across the Spider-Verse, Rise of the Beast, and then the Flash. So
yes.
We got a lot of fun stuff coming up. We hope you guys can join us, and you can also just leave some comments. Let us know what you think about Bumblebee too. And we'll be back next week to talk about the Flashpoint Paradox if it's still on HBO or actually. If it's on Max now, right?
Oh, that's right, Max.
Cool, man. Well, Brian, thank you so much. I love talking about Transformers with you. I could do that all day.
I obviously can too.
Yeah. All right, guys. We'll see you next week.